Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be hearing from St. Louis Archbishop Robert Carlson a little later in this program and get his thoughts on major issues confronting the church, including marriage and clergy sexual abuse. But first, the 1960s are historic for many reasons, not the least of which are the civil rights movement and the early days of the U.S. space program and the race to the moon. The fact that the two are connected may come as a surprise to some, but not if they have read the new book, We Could Not Fail, The First African Americans in the Space Program. It tells the story of African American NASA scientists and engineers and their work deep in the South, where they were integrated on the job, but segregated after hours. I'm joined now by the co-authors of We Could Not Fail. Stephen Moss joins us from studios at KWBU in Waco, Texas, and Richard Paul is in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Richard, I'll start with you. Can you put the times in some context for us so that we can better understand exactly what was going on?
Yeah, sure. A lot of people say, with the space program and civil rights, how did they get linked together? There actually was a sequence of events that tie them together, and it all happened over the course of about 6 weeks in 1961. President Kennedy had never talked about outer space during the campaign, and he had never talked about civil rights during the campaign. So these are two things that he was forced into during these 6 weeks. So April 12th, Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human in space, and so the Russians have won this important Cold War victory. And then on April 20th, the Bay of Pigs fails, and so now a Soviet ally is established 90 miles off of Florida, and the president calls up the vice president, who is the head of the Space Council at the time, and says, come up with something fast in space, because space is going to be the Hail Mary pass that turns everybody's attention away from Cuba. So May 5th, Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space. 9 days later, the Freedom Rides start. So that's where, black and white young people get into a bus with the whites in the back seat and the blacks in the front. May 24th, 10 days later, the bus is firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. The next day, the president commits to put an American on the moon by the end of the decade, and a week later, mobs riot around the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and the governor declares martial law. So the president has now committed to do something that is, in the end, going to end up hiring 250,000 new people in Alabama, Florida, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And Stephen has an important piece of that history that made sure that racial considerations were part of that.
Stephen?
Sure. Kennedy realized he couldn't get a civil rights bill passed because of the politics in Congress and the time. So early in his administration, he issues Executive Order 10925. And this is where we get the idea of affirmative action as well. It ends discrimination in federal contracting, or at least it makes a very good attempt to. If you're a federal contractor, you can no longer discriminate against employment on race. Federal agencies could no longer discriminate based on race. And a federal committee would be overviewing the federal agencies. So this would allow federal agencies and federal contractors to declare themselves equal opportunity employers and open the doors of American industry and federal government jobs that hadn't already been opened to African Americans. And this is especially important going into the South, where the civil rights movement is starting to move. Richard's gone through the sequence there. And as these facilities start to open, the federal facilities have to be integrated and the contractors have to show that they are hiring African Americans.
And NASA, of course, was the fastest growing federal agency in the Deep South at that time, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
They were certainly growing fast, but they started almost from zero at that time. So, they were growing very fast and adding installations and expanding installations. The expansion of Cape Canaveral in Florida wiped out an African-American community, and Richard can give you all sorts of details about that.
Sure. Yeah, it was a town founded by free blacks at the end of the Civil War. They had been given land by the government. In a sense, their 40 acres and a mule was in Florida. And there was a town with African-American businesses, African-American schools, And that was completely wiped out to make room for what is now called the Kennedy Space Center.
So what was the idea? Was the idea to hire local African-Americans or to recruit from around the country?
Well, I think that they tried to do it any way that they possibly could. And to a large extent, they failed at first. And the reason why is because they would send out white recruiters to black colleges and go to these places, the black colleges, talk to these young people and say, oh, don't worry about it. Everything will be fine when you get down south. And we talked with numerous people for the book who said, I wasn't going to believe anything that those white men told me. But in 1962, they hired a man named Charlie Smoot. And Charlie Smoot was an African-American. The NASA histories call him the first Negro recruiter in the federal government. And they were then able to send Charlie Smoot around to all of these colleges. And again, we talked with people. There's one man, E.C. Smith, who came to work at NASA in Alabama, and he said they sent two whites and one black. And the black was Charlie Smoot, and talking to him convinced me that it would be okay for me to leave where I was living and move to Alabama.
Stephen, what were they recruiting them for? What kinds of jobs? Or did it cover the whole gamut?
Well, all of them were going to be entry-level, and they would be as mathematicians, as computers, as gauge readers. And when we say computers, these are people who, while we think of computers as machines, they would do all of that math. If you remember using a slide rule and doing advanced calculations on that, that's what they did. Excuse me. So they did all of the work that a modern machine computer would do. But they also had to address, and this goes to the recruiting issue, the educational weaknesses in African-American schools in the South. Because of the segregated school systems, there was a tremendous difference in quality in education between black and white potential employees. So NASA and its contractors had to adjust and work for that. And then they found also when they did get African-Americans coming in for the engineering jobs, the mathematician jobs, the computer jobs, when they came in from the North, a lot of guys coming in from the North didn't understand the rules of living in the South as an African-American, and so they didn't stay long.
Richard, so let me get to that because it's critical. What was life like for those who decided to go to take those jobs in the South? And as I understand it from your book, many decided they didn't want to do that.
That is true. I mean, it was terrible. A telling story is that of Julius Montgomery, who's the first person we profile in the book. And mm-hmm. Julius was hired to join a team that fixed missiles. So if a missile misfired, or it didn't launch for some reason, they'd go in and diagnose the problem and fix it. Julius comes to Cape Canaveral in the mid-1950s at a time when the Ku Klux Klan controlled that part of Florida. There, the sheriff of Orange County was a Klansman. There were Klansmen who were aldermen, who were city councilmen. One person who we interviewed for the book said that businessmen would join the Klan just like joining the Rotary Club. So Julius comes in on his first day probably knowing that most of the men in his work group were going to be Klansmen. And he comes in, he's all by himself, he walks in on the first day, and he says nobody would shake his hand. He told the story about going up to each one of these guys, and they would just turn their back. They would not shake his hand. He says, I got to the last man, and I just walked up to him, and I said, hello, I'm Julius Montgomery. And he says to me, boy, that's no way to talk to a white man. And Julius says, and I looked at him and I said, oh, excuse me, oh great white bastard, what should I call you? And he says, and he laughed and I laughed and he shook my hand. But that's what it was like. I mean, when the first group of African-American engineers, a group of co-op students came from Southern University Baton Rouge to go and work at the Marshall Space Flight Center, nobody would rent them a room. Nobody would rent them a hotel room. Nobody would rent them an apartment. Charlie Smoot had to get them homes in the black community. And one of them, Morgan Watson, told a story about going to a Ray Charles concert. All the guys went in Huntsville, and there was a rope down the middle of the auditorium. All the blacks on one side, all the whites on one side, because, you know, God forbid anybody might dance together. It was the heart of Jim Crow segregation off of the base. It was just blacks and whites did not see each other, did not talk to each other. The level of separation is just unthinkable for us today, I think.
And Stephen, did that that attitude prevail throughout the 60s, or did it moderate over the years?
I think obviously it's moderated some through the years, through the past 50 years.
During that decade.
Well, during the 1960s, it did moderate some. We don't have much evidence of the social interaction of African American and white employees, particularly with regards to any civil rights things. But we also don't have much any evidence that there was animosity between the employees themselves based on color. But there is a case of one white one white NASA employee in Marshall who actually participated in civil rights activity. He went to a diner, ordered food, gave it to his black friend. Well, he was pulled out of his house at midnight, pepper sprayed, and
stripped naked.
Basically, NASA stripped down, pepper sprayed. NASA transferred him away, and nobody heard from him again. And there were rumors that his grandmother's life had been threatened, all because he was associating with blacks in Huntsville.
What about the contributions that these folks made? You said they basically came into entry-level positions. Some, I'm sure, were a little bit higher than that. But in terms of helping us put a man on the moon, what were their contributions aside from just
there? Their contributions were as great and as small as every other NASA employee. Morgan Watson, who I mentioned, helped design the heat shields for the Saturn V rocket. Clyde Foster started as a computer and ended up his principal contribution at NASA was ending NASA's whites-only advanced training program. NASA would hold advanced training in at the white university or in hotels where blacks weren't allowed to go, and Clyde had wanted to get a raise, he wanted to get a promotion, he wanted to become a supervisor. And he couldn't do it because he couldn't get the advanced training. So his principal benefit to NASA was that he worked like crazy to get NASA to create what turned out to be a separate but equal advanced training program at the black college so that black NASA employees could get better salaries and get jobs. The most important scientific contribution of an African-American in the space program was made by George Carruthers. He built the first telescope ever set up on another planetary body. He built a telescope camera that would take pictures of the Earth from the moon, do the sorts of things that the Hubble Space Telescope does now. You need to get outside of the Earth's atmosphere in order to take clear pictures of outer space. And George Carruthers was the first person to build a telescope that was ever placed on another planetary body. Are some of the things that they did. Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, I have to take a break, but I'm just going to say that you could ask 99 out of 100 people to explain who he was, and they would have no idea. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. We have to take a break. We're talking with Stephen Moss and Richard Paul, the co-authors of We Could Not Fail. It's about the African-American involvement in the NASA space program during the 1960s. Early on, the contributions that they made, those who were with NASA. We'll come back in just a moment, continue the conversation. If you'd like to get into it, give us a call at 382-8255 or 382-TALK. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7. KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Stephen Moss and Richard Paul, co-authors of We Could Not Fail, which is the story of African-American involvement in the U.S. space program during the early 60s. Gentlemen, as I look over some of the information from your book, gleaned from your book, it seems that NASA's record overall over the years has not been terribly impressive, with only about 3% of the workforce being African-American. However, today, the NASA administrator is African-American.
Stephen, why don't you take that? You're the number guy.
Sure. Well, you're right. NASA's employment of African Americans throughout the 1960s averaged about 3%. And as their numbers, overall employment numbers increased and the absolute numbers of NASA employees increased, so did the percent sometimes. The problem, of course, is on different facilities because in 1965, for example, in Mississippi, there were no NASA-employed African-Americans at the Mississippi site. But in 1964, there were only 11 of them at Florida. So NASA tried to a certain degree, and NASA failed to a certain degree. But it's made strides with General Bolden, certainly, who's a terrific guy. And
that's Charles Bolden, the administrator.
Charles Bolden, General mm-hmm. Charles Bolden, NASA administrator. He is a terrific guy. We had a chance to meet him. And with African-American astronauts and further African-American contributions. But this is also, just looking at NASA employment, we look at NASA contractors. And everybody who has – every private business concern that has a federal contract with NASA – is an equal opportunity employer. They have African-American employees now that they would not have had 40 and 50 years ago.
But overall, and Richard, I'll turn to you on this, overall the aerospace industry's record is not sterling.
It's beyond not sterling. There was an article in Fortune magazine that we found that said, you will find almost universal prejudice against Negroes at aircraft plants. There was little concealment of the anti-Negro policy. And, you know, it's kind of backing that up are some of the outrageous statements that were made by aviation executives at the time. The head of North American Aviation, which ended up building the Apollo space capsule, was asked about hiring African Americans when they were planning a new plant in Kansas City in the 1940s. He said, regardless of their training as aircraft workers, we will not employ Negroes in the North American plant. While we are in complete sympathy with the Negro, it is against our company policy to employ them as mechanics or aircraft workers. He said, African Americans would only be hired as janitors. Imagine that as the bar you've got to get past. You know, we gave a talk at the National Air and Space Museum, Stephen and I did, a couple of years ago, and a conversation broke out among the curators at the end of our talk about whether NASA did enough. And a white curator was saying, you know what, they didn't, and how can you say that this was an advance or anything like this? And then an African-American curator said, how many tenured PhD African-American professors were there at Harvard in 1961? And he said, well, you know, probably one. And he said, yeah, so if there were three a few years later, would you consider that to be an advancement? You really have to look at the numbers in terms of compared to what. Mm-hmm. You know, NASA, you can say that in terms of raw numbers, NASA didn't make a difference. And that is absolutely true. But one of the things that Morgan Watson said to us in the book was that NASA helped change the view of people in the South about African Americans by showing that there were African Americans who could do these jobs. You proved that African Americans could do it. And that is the civil rights victory, I think, that the people in our book achieved. We hear so much about the protests and the sit-ins and the lawsuits by the NAACP, and of course those were vitally important. What these individuals did was achieve a civil rights victory by showing up to work every day and operating at the very highest level of American science and technology. The title of our book, We Could Not Fail, comes from that idea. One of the people we talked about said, we thought that the entire image of black people in America was riding on us, and we could not fail. Because if they had, it wouldn't have been, oh, Morgan's no good, or you know what, George is no good. It would have been, those people can't handle this work. And that's why it was so important that these people were doing the work that they were doing in NASA at that time.
I have to point out that St. Louis played a role in that during that period of time because McDonnell Douglas was here at the day before Boeing acquired it. And there was a discrimination suit filed by Percy Green, a well-known activist here. That went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he won it, claiming he was discriminated against in employment at McDonnell Douglas. So it was going on in various parts of the country, obviously.
Yes,
it was.
Yes, it was.
While we're on this subject, let me take a call. We've got Tim waiting, who's calling from West County. He wants to get into this whole idea of recruiting. Go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
So I was wondering if there was any recruiting at the Parks Air College, which is part of St. Louis University, which had been integrated prior to this time by Father Reiner.
Do either of you gentlemen know?
You know, Charlie Smoot said he went everywhere. So he didn't say specifically where he went, but I know he came north. He went to Michigan. He also went out west to California. They were looking everywhere they possibly could, to the automotive industry, to the airplane construction industry, looking for people that knew engines, that knew motors, that knew thrust and propulsion, trying to find African Americans anywhere that they could. So I don't know about that specific school, but Charlie Smoot said he went everywhere.
The only reason I mention that is Gene Cernan came from there. He wrote that book, Failure is Not an Option, which popped into my head as soon as I heard about what you were talking about for the people who were being recruited by NASA. I didn't know if there was some sort of a fraternity there of Parks Air College people that might have gotten into NASA through that kind of a thing.
We wouldn't offhand, unless Richard knows something that he's waiting for a sequel. I don't know of any. Because most of our work focused on the Deep South, plus contractors NASA contractor employees elsewhere.
Yep.
So we didn't really keep a track of beyond Southern University of what schools people went to or whether there was a group from a particular school from outside of the South.
Yeah, and as you mentioned that, I know that in 1963, there was a summit at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, and they invited the presidents of the black colleges. Now we call them the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities, but at that time, the black colleges. The presidents of the black colleges were invited to NASA, and I think that it sounds like the one that you're talking about was a college that had been not integrated and then was integrated. They would not have been focusing on that school in particular. They were looking to the black colleges to try and find engineers and technicians and so forth.
You know, Stephen, I think I know the answer to this question, but we're talking about men primarily. I don't think there were probably too many black women who were involved in any of this.
There were African-American women employed, obviously, by NASA at some facilities, but not that we know of in that we dealt with this book.
I think they were in
other facilities. I don't know of any that were at Huntsville or at the regions that we looked at.
I read a couple of reports where NASA, and you know, this is enlightening. Not only are we dealing with racism here, but also sexism. NASA in Houston and NASA in Florida and NASA in Alabama went out to find women, but what they looked for was typists. And there were a couple of reports that I came across in doing research where they said, you know, we brought a bunch of women in to take the civil service typing test, and they didn't pass. So we tried to hire black women, but we couldn't. So what you've got there is, a combination of the racism and the sexism that I don't know that NASA was necessarily looking for women to be engineers or technicians.
Racism and sexism, that's one heck of a 1-2 punch, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Sure. Yes, I think, is the reason why all of the people in our book are men.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up the question of women because the first African-American astronaut, Mae Jemison, did a blurb for your book, and she raised an issue that I think is maybe relevant to what's been going on in our part of the country here. She says, I consider We Could Not Fail a must-read for everyone, particularly so in a time when society is once again openly struggling with the civil rights issue. A lot of people, I think maybe you two gentlemen included, think she was making reference to Ferguson there. Who'd like to start?
I think that she might have been. There was an idea that an activist federal government, there was an idea on the part of the most liberal members of the Kennedy administration, principally led by Vice President Johnson, that an activist federal government could go into the South and have a strong hand in changing the South. Now, Johnson believed that if you could change the economy of the South, you could defeat racism. He naively believed that in the time. I think that what Dr. Jemison was saying there was that an activist federal government, I know that she wrote this right about, she wrote that book blurb, she sent it to us right about the time that the Justice Department was considering getting, whether or not to get involved in Ferguson. And I assume that that was on her mind, that this idea that the federal government can play a role in addressing the inequities in society.
Stephen, what do you see as the relevance of this book in today's world?
Well, other than just telling stories that even some of the family members of these gentlemen weren't aware of until Richard came calling to do interviews and then the book comes out, is small stories matter. We're all used, Richard talked about the history of the civil rights stories that get told. We all know about Von Braun. We know Jim Webb. We know the Mercury. More people can name the Mercury 7 astronauts than can probably name any active astronaut right now. These are not the guys that you would necessarily know about. They were entry level. They were young men in their 20s or 30s, starting out engineers, computers, technicians. These are the small stories that built the space program and maintained the space program. And they happened to be African Americans and among the first to break the color bar. And that's important to know. And it's important, as Morgan Watson said, that they could not fail, that these gentlemen knew what was at stake. And despite all of the obstructions in their way, whether it was George Wallace, federal hiring practices, the aerospace industry, tradition and culture, they prevailed through grace and courage and competency. They prevailed. They did not fail.
One of the things that has always struck me about this period, and I lived through it, was the fact that hailed as a hero and so very, very prominent during this time when black Americans were struggling, was a scientist who worked for Adolf Hitler and became a hero of our space program, Wernher von Braun.
Yes, it's true.
Yes.
Yes, it's true. And when NASA needed a counterweight to George Wallace in the mid-1960s, they turned to Wernher von Braun because nobody had as much authority in Alabama as Wernher von Braun. I mean, aside from George Wallace, nobody in Alabama had as much authority as Wernher von Braun. And it is beyond ironic that Wernher von Braun went around to chambers of commerce all around Alabama and said, you need to treat Negroes better than you are doing so now. And that Wernher von Braun, who built rockets for Hitler, went to black colleges, to the groundbreaking ceremonies of science centers at black colleges. I can't get inside of Wernher von Braun's head.
I would add a couple of more things. He also represented in Alabama, because he had been there since the 1950s, he represented modernity. He was the face of the modern age, countering that. So he became a tremendous symbol of an industrialized Alabama economy. How to put this as far as his being the great civil libertarian, part of it might have been he was obeying orders. We've had people say that Von Braun wanted to build rockets and he would do so As long as you let him build rockets, he would do whatever you told him to do.
Just following orders, but correct.
Just following orders. But he was this tremendous force there. And I'm not sure the Alabama story, what Huntsville could have held out against Wallace the way it did without a personality as strong as Von Braun's.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and we've already established that JFK, John Kennedy, used Jobs as muscle, I think you put it, in his DSEG mm-hmm. strategy. But what about LBJ? I mean, he gets the credit for so much of what happened during that era with regard to civil rights. He picked up the baton immediately, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was the one that thought that the space program was what was going to help change the South. He always saw the space program as a jobs program. He didn't buy into all that stuff about science and advancement and all of that and beating the Russians. He saw this as a jobs program that the Republicans would go along with. They would not object to a federal program that hired 250,000 people if they could talk about it as being a way to beat the Russians to the moon. So he saw this as a way to create new jobs in the South where nobody could say, you know what, a black man can't do that job because no one had ever done that job before. Mm-hmm. So we give Lyndon Johnson tons and tons of credit in the book.
So in the minute and a half that we have left, what does Stephen, I'll start with you here. What put you guys onto this story? What sparked your interest in this?
Well, 20 years ago, I was in graduate school at Texas Tech needing a thesis topic, and I started to see a bunch of little stories and went to my advisor, and he said, if it's ever, you know, if it's important, somebody's already done this, but go ahead and look. And I looked and came up with a master's thesis, and 15 years later, after it sat on the shelf for all those years, Richard Paul joins the conversation. So, Richard, take
right.
it from there.
I was at a NASA conference on the human dimensions of spaceflight, how the space program affected art, how it affected journalism, et cetera. And a guy got up and said, and we need to poke around into some of these dimmer corners of the space program. For instance, I read this fascinating paper by a graduate student named Stephen Moss about civil rights in the space program. Well, I'm a documentary producer. I was looking for a topic, and I went to my friend who had organized the conference. I said, Roger, you got to get me that paper that guy talked about. I read it. I said, this is amazing. Well, no one has ever talked about this before, and I called Stephen.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I think a lot of people will as they read the book and learn this fascinating part of our history that up until now was so little known. Thank you, Stephen Moss and Richard Paul, co-authors of We Could Not Fail, for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Archbishop Robert Carlson. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.